at the center of most large galaxies. Yez is only the fourth woman to win the Nobel Prize in Physics after Marie Curie in 1903, Maria Goeppert Mayer in 1963, and Donna Strickland in 2018. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS.
WS2N?
Yes, Paul.
Did you say the award was for discovering the black holes themselves or the super massive black holes? I thought the regular black holes were confirmed a long time ago. Maybe not. What are you saying? Roy, back to you.
Well, the nature of the Nobel Prizes is you can give it to at least three people and they have to be alive. So what they decided to do was take black holes as a general subject, give half the prize to Roger Penrose, who basically wrote the equations that demonstrated how they could exist based on Einstein's theory of relativity back in 65, and then they combined two women who demonstrated that the actions of stars close to the center of our galaxy were consistent with a black hole. This is probably the first black hole that was kind of proved by observational science. It's gone on for decades, and we've learned more and more about the black hole in the center of our galaxy. But I think that was the first black hole that people felt comfortable knowing that was what was going on before the others were found and before we had things like gravity waves that demonstrated the birth of such things.
Okay, just I remember Stephen Hawking. He was big on the black holes. So I figured he got the credit for it. But okay, this is work that was done to eventually discover it. Very good. Okay, back to you.
Yeah, I mean, once again, unfortunately, you cannot get a Nobel Prize posthumously. So the fact that Stephen Hawking passed away does not let him be a candidate. This was a big political problem when the Nobel Prize for DNA was given, and one of the people who was fundamentally important in taking the X-ray crystallography images that demonstrated the double helix of DNA had died, I think, of either ovarian cancer or cervical cancer long before the award was given. So she wasn't included in it. So I don't know if it's particularly fair that you can't get it posthumously, but that's the rules that Alfred Nobel, I guess, set up way back when.
Okay, the DNA, is that the one where the guy Watson got it from Cold Spring Harbor?
Yeah, it was Watson, Crick, and one other guy, and I forget the woman's name, I think it was Russ or Russell, Rosa something, I forget, unfortunately. Watson and Crick became very famous with the discovery of the double helix.
Very good. Okay, I'll let you go on.
Okay. This past Wednesday, the Royal Swedish Academy of Sciences awarded the Nobel Prize in Chemistry to French scientist Emmanuel Charpentier and U.S. scientist Jennifer Doudna for their pivotal roles in the discovery of CRISPR. We've talked about that too here. An ancient bacterial defense system that's been adapted into a cheap and revolutionary gene editing technology. This is the first Nobel Prize in Chemistry to be shared exclusively by two women. CRISPR is short for Clustered Regularly Interspaced Short Palindromic Repeats. It describes a system of genetic sequences found in bacteria and similar microorganisms. A CRISPR system is made from bits of repeating DNA as well as regularly spaced sections where other DNA sequences are fit into it. In bacteria, these open spaces are filled with the genetic material of harmful viruses encountered in the past. This allows the bacteria to recognize the problem virus in the future as well as to target the invader using enzymes called Cas, C-A-S, that slice its genetic structure to ribbons. In short, CRISPR-Cas acts as a rudimentary and ancient immune system for bacteria. Charpentier wasn't the first to discover the existence of CRISPR-Cas, but in 2011, she and her team published research from their work with strep bacteria that revealed a never-before-seen aspect of CRISPR crucial to its function called tracker RNA molecule. This paved the way to Charpentier's work with Doudna, then working at the University of California, Berkeley, on one particular form of CRISPR, the CRISPR-Cas9 system. Let me drop for a sec. Charpentier, Doudna, and their colleagues were the first to recreate CRISPR-Cas9 in the lab outside of finding it naturally in bacteria. Even more important, they showed that it was possible to reproduce the system to target other pieces of DNA, not just those belonging to viruses. This simple finding meant that CRISPR-Cas9 could be turned into a pair of scissors used by scientists to edit the genes of almost any living thing, with fewer resources needed than other gene editing technologies available at the time. It's fair to say that this discovery ushered in a new age of genetic engineering, with already tangible results in everything from agriculture to human cancer research. Quote, there is enormous power in this genetic tool, which affects us all. It has not only revolutionized basic science, but also results in innovative crops and will lead to groundbreaking new medical treatments, end quote, said Klaas Gustafsson, chief of the Nobel Committee for Chemistry, in a statement announcing the award. Let me drop for a sec. Charpentier and Doudna were two of the scientists most involved in a fierce legal battle over the patents surrounding CRISPR-Cas9, facing off primarily against scientists from MIT's Broad Institute. To make a very long story short, Charpentier and Doudna had filed for patents in early 2012, recognizing them as the creators of the technology that allowed it to be adapted into a gene editing tool. However, the Broad Institute filed patents 6 months later that sought credit instead, since their work was the first to show CRISPR could be applied to human cells. Ultimately, the patent office largely sided with the Broad Institute, so some patents were later given to Charpentier and Doudna's team, and there are still some disputes over the intellectual property of the technology left to be settled. Many of the scientists involved in early CRISPR research, including Doudna, have since gone on to found companies invested in using CRISPR to pilot new treatments and applications. There are ongoing clinical trials involving its use as treatment for cancer and sickle cell disease, while it's already been used to improve health and disease resistance of certain crops. Others are working on ways to refine CRISPR to become even more precise. But there have always been thorny ethical questions about this use, especially when it was first discovered in late 2018 that the Chinese scientist He Jiankou, who we also talked a great deal about, had genetically modified at least three babies with CRISPR in an attempt to make them resistant to HIV. The Chinese government eventually sentenced He Jiankou to 3 years in prison for his experiments, while it remains uncertain whether the children are truly resistant to the virus or free of any unexpected sequence consequence from genetic alteration. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS. Okie doke. Well, those are the two major Nobel Prizes of the week. If anything pops up next week that's of interest, I'll consider including it in a presentation. As always, I want to thank everyone who participated tonight. I wanted to thank Andy for Andy's Corner, WA2CBL, and remind people, if you have any questions and you can't reach the technical net, our old mailbag feature that isn't being used that much these days, or any topics you would like to hear discussed, or want to refute something, or share a link with me, or a puzzle, then please, the email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. The link page, there's already one thing linked up there, and we'll see as time goes on if I can find something else to link, is available at roy.ac2gs.com. And the stream, as always, is available on the internet at technet.ac2gs.com. And remember that MikeKC2NJI has his archive site, amateurradio.tv, where he has archives of the Limark Technical Net that go as far back as September of 2006. So once again, thanks to everyone, and I will call for Paul WS2N with the SpaceNet report.
One small thing, we have still have a time.
Okay, Wes, but it has to be a small thing.
Yeah, and this is in regard to the conversation that we had over the email about the explanation and evidence of fracturing piezo rocks producing neutrons. And I believe I found some explanation for it just for you to. So I'm going to just give you the quick quote that's from Columbia, Missouri, University of Missouri, because you put in question that that couldn't happen, and I believe that I found why it's probably happening. So they have, in 1991, they observed intense neutron bursts. The temperature shocking titanium chips, which had been saturated with deuterium gas at temperature of 77 Kelvin. So they actually cooled those chips and then rapidly heated it into 323 Kelvin, and that produced a large pressure and in the crystalline, and they observed 2 million neutrons counted over the period of 5 minutes. Let me jump. Takes probably one more minute. Okay, so then I was trying to avoid Carpinelli and all other Italian physicists and just go to the articles of other physicists, and then I found something that was done by both Russians and by Americans. So in Russians, they observed the nuclear reaction from deuterium, palladium, and titanium irradiated by an electron beam, an X-ray beam. And charged particles have been detected by CR39 track detectors, which shows the production of neutrons. Now, that gave me the incentive to look at the Japanese who works at Northeastern University, and he actually explained that. The elastic energy of microcrack production ultimately yields to microscopic fracture. The mechanical energy is converted to the piezoelectric effect into the electric field energy. The electric field energy decays with radio frequency, microwave, electric field oscillation. The radio frequency fields accelerate to condensed matter electrons, which then collide with the protons producing neutrons and neutrinos. But actually, the explanation is a little bit different. Whenever you crack the rock, you have X-ray. You're creating X-ray. And X-ray was actually explaining here that the energy that could be bombarding an atom, and eventually it is, as a photon, it is blamed for affecting, or, yeah, that's something wrong with it, affecting the nucleus, ripping off the neutrons out of it. Just a quick comment on it, and thank you very much.
Okay, Wes, if you want to send me links to these articles, I'll take a look at them. I guess, theoretically, if you have some bizarre bunch of things that impart high energy to an electron, enough for it to rip through a nucleus, you can induce some kind of nuclear effect. I don't think it's something you can pin any kind of device consistently to operate. And I don't know. Is it theoretically possible if you kind of pose it that way? Maybe, sort of. The one that your Italian source required basically throwing out Einstein's general theory of relativity in favor of a Lorentzian one, which has no proof whatsoever. So the rationale that they were using of distorted space-time is highly theoretical and very dubious. So I don't know what to make of it, but, you know, you can always send it to me.
Thank you very much for your time, and to Xian.
Okay, thanks for participating. Once again, all with the SpaceNet report, WS2N.
AC2GS, WS2N for the SpaceNet report for the TechNet. Very good, and good topics tonight. I like the puzzle, and it rings a bell. I think that's probably got to be 3 decades old, if not longer. I remember it way back when. So, very good. China sent their spacecraft to Mars, and this happened. There were three launches at the end of July and early part of August, and three of them were from three different countries. Japan had launched their spacecraft for the United Arab Emirates called HOPE. That's still on the way to Mars. That got off the ground successfully. That's going to be an orbiter. And we launched Perseverance, a monstrous rover that was also launched early August. And that's on the way to Mars, and as well as China. So three different countries. China launched, it's like a 3-in-1 deal. An orbiter that's going to go into orbit, and then after a couple months, they're going to decide on sending the lander down. They'll have a lander, and then inside the lander, they're going to have a rover. But, you know, what they did was something I always thought would be a good idea for you know, any spacecraft that gets launched. They sent their... They had a camera on board the cruise stage. You know, right now it's cruising between here and Mars. All three countries, all their launches are roughly about halfway there now. They're all due to land in February. We'll get to Mars in February. But what they had on this China vehicle was a camera that they released halfway there, and the camera floated away, and it's linked by UHF to the cruise stage. So this way, communicate directly to the cruise stage, and the cruise stage is able to send the pictures back to Earth, and which they did. And the camera, even though it was floating, was, you know, no real control on the motion of the camera itself, just kind of drifting. So they had it set up where it would take a picture every, you know, a couple of seconds. And what they did is they eventually, in the field of view, they got their spacecraft, you know, with the solar panels, and you could see the aero shell and the spacecraft part that's going to go through the atmosphere with the heat shield. You could see all that. So it was pretty neat. I thought that was a good idea. And we've done something similar to that, but it's, you know, not quite as dramatic. Not quite as dramatic as the picture. We had sent two CubeSats on the InSight lander, the InSight lander that went to Mars. It's sitting on Mars now for a couple of years. But when that went, the two CubeSats, they were called Marco A, Marco B. And they had separated early on. They were attached to the upper launch vehicle, and they followed InSight all the way to Mars. But they stayed like 8,000 miles behind. They didn't want to take a chance of these things accidentally crashing into the cruise stage for InSight. And then as it got closer, they brought it up to around 2,000 miles away. But they were primarily using them as communication devices. As the spacecraft, you know, enters the atmosphere of Mars, it was able to send the information, you know, all the telemetry, and some pictures back to the CubeSats, and in turn they sent it back to Earth. It was kind of like acting as a backup system, because they have that capability anyway. They have the ability to send pictures to orbiting spacecraft, such as the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter, and we have a couple more up there. That was the primary way of doing it, but the Marco ones was the backup, and they really just wanted to see if it would work, because, you know, kind of proof of concept type of deal. This way they'll be able to use it on future missions, and they already are. They've got a plan for one to go to the moon, another one to go to Psyche, which is an asteroid going around Jupiter, near Jupiter in the Trojan area, they call it, the L4 area. But there is a planned mission to go there, and, you know, they're going to use these CubeSats, because they were both very successful in the future. But I thought China did pretty good with that picture, in-flight deal. You know, I've seen it before with a geosynchronous satellite that not too long ago that we have. Northrop Grumman sent a repair mission up to a geosynchronous satellite, and that's pretty good. They took a picture of the other satellite before it docked with it. I think that's always pretty interesting. You know, of course, we've seen plenty of this stuff dating back to the Gemini days, when Gemini used to go up and rendezvous with the docking Agena spacecraft, or even when the two Geminis went up together, and they photographed each other. You had four people in space at one time back then. Oh, it's a big deal. Two separate spacecraft, and of course all the missions to the moon, and, you know, with the separation and the docking of the lunar modules with the command module. So always good to have these pictures from the space. And of course, we have thousands of pictures from the International Space Station, spacecraft approaching, or spacecraft taking pictures of the space station itself. So I thought I'd bring that up before I move on. Any questions, comments? This is WS2N. Okay. The Starlink broadband system started to come along. It says SpaceX keeps launching these Falcon 9 rockets. Every time they do, they launch about 60 communication satellites, each one weighing about 500 pounds, each one having ion engines on board to control their location in space. They're all in relatively low for the computers. Not like, you know, it's a geosynchronous orbit, there would be a big delay. These things are very quick. They believe it's going to be even quicker than terrestrial cable systems. So they got another one off the ground about a week ago. It was delayed like three or four times due to weather, but they finally did launch it. So that gives them well over 700 satellites. They're up to 775 that they have launched. They need really around 800-900 to make the system viable. But they did put it into use with all the fires in state of Washington, for instance, in Oregon. There's so many cell towers and things that are out of business because of the fires. SpaceX did energize some of those, so you got some communications in and out with these things. They could do you know, anything you would get on the internet, or even 4K TV, they say, with the Starlink system. They're doing good there. They have deorbited some of them, the earlier ones. There were an earlier iteration of the satellites. Apparently, some of them might not be working, or they don't like the design of it. But for whatever reason, they've deorbited, they said, like 47 of these things so far, and which is relatively easy to do. You know, they just turn the satellite in the opposite direction where they're going, and they put on their ion engine. Their ion engine works on krypton instead of the standard xenon gas that most of the engines work on. Krypton is a lot cheaper, so they're putting up thousands of these satellites eventually. They went with the less expensive fuel. That's the story on Starliner. Any questions or comments? All right, this story is, it's actually a news story, but it's weird. It's kind of like an extension of the one that we had last week, and I believe the time before that. But last week, Wesley was talking about looking under the ground and trying to figure out what's underneath the ground and what type of systems they have. And I brought up the fact that, on Curiosity, they have something called DAN. DAN is an acronym. It was built by Russia, and it actually could send out neutrons or whatever to under the ground, and by whatever they see coming back, they can more or less tell what's underneath, if there's ice or anything like that. So we talked about that last week, and actually that system, I think, failed after a few years, but Dan was the name of that setup. It was located, they had a piece on in the middle of the rover Curiosity, and then one on the left as a receiver, and another one on the right. And they could also do passive reception if gamma rays or something hitting the ground on a normal basis, or cosmic rays. Whatever's coming back from the ground, these passive ones could also receive it, but they can only go down, they said, maybe 20 inches or so into the ground. The new rover, Perseverance, that we talked about before, that's on the way to Mars, halfway there, has a setup located in the rear of the rover, and it's going to send radio frequency or radar underground. It's called the radar image for Mars subsurface experiment. So they have another big long acronym. This one is RIMFAX, RIMFAX, and Wesley might like to look it up because he's fascinated, I think, with this type of thing. But it's not going to use, neutrons or anything like that to detect anything. They're actually going to send radio waves down through the surface. But the depth, I was shocked to see how far it would penetrate. So I'm trying to figure out the frequency. I haven't figured it out yet, what band they're going to be on. But it's going to be able to go down, they say, 10 meters. So, like, over 30 feet on the ground to see if there's any kind of water. As this thing drives along, it will be able to, if it's transmitting, it will make a picture of what it's looking at below. And it's located on the rover. If you look at the rover, now the front of the rover has this big robotic arm, this seven-foot robotic arm coming out, so you can tell that's the front. The six-wheel vehicle. It's roughly, a square-like type of vehicle. It's a little over 10 feet by 10 feet. And but in the back, you can see this piece that goes up on an angle, roughly around a 30-degree angle. And that's the That's where the power supply is located, the RTG, the radioisotope thermoelectric generator. And you can see these tubes all, like, attached to the outside of it. And those tubes are actually picking up heat from that radioisotope thermoelectric generator. You know, they take the idea of that thing is to produce power, electrical power for the rover. You know, it puts out roughly 110, they say 109 watts of energy. So, you know, from heat, and the heat goes into you know the surrounding area, which is surrounded by these graphite blankets, and inside the graphite blankets there's dozens of these bimetal strips, nothing but thermocouplings, and they're all hooked up in series and parallel to the point where they get enough amperage and voltage to get 110 watts out of this thing. But that's only about like maybe 20% of the heat that's being used for that purpose. There's another like 1,200 watts that's being wasted. So they take, what they do is they take that heat and they put it into the these coils that are surrounding the RTG, and then they send that heat down to different locations on the rover using these tubes and keep things nice and toasty. Don't forget it gets, you know, you get minus 140 degrees or something is normal at night. And you can't have that on a rover, so it keeps things warm. And also in the daytime, I mean, you could get up to, 60, 70 degrees on Mars. But in general, it's cold, and it needs to keep its electronics and everything warm. Located right below this, and if you look in the back, it's this triangular piece. And that's where RIMFAX is located, this radar type of piece of equipment looking straight down to penetrate the ground as it drives along looking for ice or water. So I thought that was pretty good. So if anybody wants to look that up, you bring up Mars Perseverance, RIMFAX, RIMFAX, and if anybody finds out what frequency it is, let me know. I'm very curious to find out. I think it's, I can't believe it's going to be that high of a frequency, because the higher the frequency you go, I think the harder it is to penetrate the ground. But the couple of articles I found so far have not mentioned what frequency or band it is. This is WS2. Anyway, they've tested this thing out. You know, they brought it up to Greenland and places with a lot of ice, and they put it on the back of a they've had a sled, put it on the sled, and then drove it around with the snowmobile, you know, to see how good it works. That's the story on that. Any comments or questions? WS2N. Okay. Is something I was going to talk about last week, but I never got to it. You have a another astronaut going up this week, actually maybe within about 7 days or so, to the International Space Station. Her name is Dr. Kate Rubin. She's been up to the International Space Station before. She's going up with two Russians on a Soyuz rocket being launched from Kazakhstan from Baikonur Launch Complex. And she's a ham, so she'll be contacting schools, I'm sure, when she's up there. But anyway, this is her second trip to the space station. She'll be up there for about 6 months, which means that she'll be up there next month. If she goes up next week and there's no delays, she's going to be up there for Election Day. So I've talked about this probably years ago on the net to some degree. But they do have the capability of voting from space, and what they'll do is, they all want from, they all train, the Americans train in Texas, down by the, in the Johnson Space Center. So most of them are signed up with the ability to cast their votes from Texas. So what they do is, before Election Day, they were emailed up from NASA with this encrypted ballot that's sent up, and they get it, they look at it, and they make their choices, and they transmit it back down to NASA, and then you know, like I said, it's all encrypted, so nobody knows who they voted for, and that's how they do it. Now, by the time election time comes, there was supposed to be another group going up. Four people were going to launch on a Falcon 9 on the 31st of this month. But it looks like it's being delayed until probably mid-November, so I think they're going to miss Election Day. I think only Kate will be up there doing it. But it's been done before. It's really not new, but sometimes it doesn't get any news coverage. First time it was actually done was with David Wolf, and it wasn't even on the International Space Station. It was on Mir. Mir was the Russian space station, which stayed up there like 15 years. And we used to have shuttles that used to visit Mir. And it was a great way of actually practicing. It was before the International Space Station was even, you know, before we even had one piece up there. We were sending shuttles to Mir, bringing up astronauts and cosmonauts and bringing them back down again. And they had a, you know, a special docking adapter for the American shuttle, which was a little different than set up over Soyuz, but we sent five different shuttles to the Mir space station over the years, and of course when that eventually deorbited, I think around 2000, we were off to the races building the International Space Station. So any questions about voting outside of my comment is, you got to go out and vote. That's a priority. Don't miss that. Any comments or questions? WS2N. Okay. Let's see. There was a launch also last week. But again, one of the ones that was delayed. We finally got from Wallops Island, Virginia. Not too far from here, and it was launched on an Antares rocket. On top of that was the cargo vehicle Cygnus, which eventually berthed is the real word they use for the cargo vehicles. With the International Space Station, they connected it to the Earth-facing port. Unity. So, you know, Unity is one of the many modules that are attached to the space station. So that's now bolted up. And when they do that, there's 16 actual bolts they physically don't do it. It's driven electrically. And once it connects, the bolts are, you know, they catch the threads. And you know, pull the vehicle into place. You know, there's a big gasket around there to make sure the 14.7 pounds per square inch don't leak out of the spacecraft or out of the International Space Station. And eventually, when the pressure test the vestibule, they call it, the area. You know, from where the gasket is to the actual door, and make sure that's okay. If they bring that up to pressure and there's no leaks, they're able to open up these. They look like square garage doors. They pull out and then they ride up on these tracks, and the astronauts are able to go in there and bring stuff out. They have like 8,000 pounds worth of stuff on Cygnus. So they'll bring, you know, everything, food to EVA equipment, you know, for spacewalks, and tons of science equipment. And when they're done doing that, eventually they're going to load it up with trash over the next couple of months, and eventually we'll deorbit. First they'll unberth it from the International Space Station. It'll float away. And actually, before they deorbit it, they're going to fly it to a higher altitude. And it will function as an independent satellite for probably a month. And they run some tests that, you know, Grumman would like to do, you know, as an independent satellite. And eventually they create a fire inside. They've done this maybe three or four different times with the Cygnus spacecraft. They'll actually create a fire, and they'll test the different materials, how it burns. They'll test the they'll photograph it. They'll know how the flames go, and they learn more about fire and fire safety in space. And then eventually they'll deorbit it over the South Pacific. That's the story on Cygnus. Any comments or questions? WS2N? Okay, we have a crew change coming up. The Starliner spacecraft, we've talked about that before. It was well under development. In fact, they had launched last year a Starliner spacecraft on an Atlas V rocket to the International Space Station. Unfortunately, never made it there. It got it to low Earth orbit, and it had some problems. Computer code apparently was wrong between the spacecraft and the, you know, the booster, and it just they had the wrong information in there. Thrusters started firing unnecessarily, thinking, you know, the spacecraft thought it was somewhere else, and it should have been somewhere else. It was trying to get to where it was supposed to be, and eventually they deorbited the spacecraft and brought it back safely to land. New Mexico desert, they brought it back down from white sand with the big airbag, and it landed successfully. Didn't have a crew on board. Eventually it will. The idea was to bring it up to the space station and back autonomously, just like SpaceX did with their crew version of the Dragon. They had done that previously before they started launching crews up to the space station. And since that failed, NASA has made some 80 different changes to Starliner. And eventually they'll be able to launch it again, maybe springtime of next year. And then if that's successful, if they do make it to the space station, they're able to open the door, the crew is able to go in and poke around and eventually deorbit the Starliner back to Earth. Then the crew will go, and they have a crew that's been training for this for a long time, and the commander is Chris Ferguson. He's backing out. He's no kid anymore. He said he's going back with his family. I think he's had enough with the delays, and should have been up there last year. And he's being replaced by his, they always have a backup, this one guy, Barry Whitmore. Whitmore. He's been up to the space station before, a couple of flights. Another well-experienced guy. So there's a crew change. For now, he's got two other people going with him. So one other guy he's flown before, and then a woman. That's the deal. Time marches on. If there's too many delays, eventually he starts making crew changes. Okay, this week, this spacecraft I want to talk about, OSIRIS-REx, launched a few years ago, three and a half years ago, to an asteroid called Bennu. Bennu is a 1,500-foot-long asteroid. So it's a big asteroid. And the goal is to send a spacecraft to this asteroid, get very close to it. It's got this big ring on the end of a robot arm, and it's going to bring material back from the asteroid. It's been orbiting this asteroid like for a year, taking pictures and going close to the asteroid and all kinds of not only radar but LIDAR, and you know, it's just examining this thing, not only for the science of it, but to make sure they want to be able to pick the best location where they can come down with their robotic arm. From what I understand, they got one or two tries to do this. And as the arm comes in close, touches the asteroid, it's got nitrogen charge that's going to force the material from the surface into this, what I call like a catcher's mitt. And then that'll close it up, and eventually the robotic arm will put it into a descent module that's on board the spacecraft. That will be like practically hermetically sealed. But it's still going to take like, I think it's 2024 by the time it comes back here. And it's going to deorbit from Bennu and head back toward Earth, and eventually separate from the Osiris-Rex, and then this descent module will come through the atmosphere. They're going to send it to Utah. They have a desert-like area out in Utah, and that's where they plan on landing it, and they'll be able to pick it up and bring it to open it up, and you know, for the scientists, they'll have a ball with the stuff for the next probably 20 years looking at it. So that will be done this week. But with all the news with the politics and everything that's going on, and I don't know if it's going to make the news. Usually, something like this would make the news. But that's what we have the net for. Any other questions, comments? This is WSY. Okay, nothing heard. Just want to mention this one thing that took place a week or so ago. It was this slow scan TV from the ISS. Russia was transmitting a slow scan TV on the amateur band for anybody to copy. So I went to the site where, you know, apparently this is finished now. They were doing it on the 4th, 5th, 6th, I think up until the 8th. And it was really to celebrate the Sputnik launch, you know, for the Russians some 60 years ago. And they had these pictures, the various pictures. One of them was of a satellite. Now, I don't have that capability, but it was coming down on 2 meters, and must have been pretty good. I'm not really sure how I would be able to do this. You know, I guess I can get the software, put it through the computer, but the radio itself, you need to, you know, it's got you got to tune to 145.800. That's no problem. But then there's a plus or minus 3 kilohertz for Doppler shift. That's kind of weird. You know, I have HCs. I have ICOM 2100. You know. None of these radios, these are not all-band radios. That means that I assume what these people are using are all-band radios. I wonder if anybody knows that. But that would be interesting to do. Not that they're doing it anymore, but I guess they'll do it in the future to get slow-scan TV from the International Space Station. I'm sure, you know, any kind of outdoor antenna probably would have worked on 145.800. Any comments or answers to that question? This is WS2N. Okay, nothing heard. So I'll have to research that for further. You know, maybe just downloading on that frequency is good enough, and you know, you don't need, you know, maybe, you know, you can get one of the pictures before you it gets affected by the Doppler as it leaves. Anyway, any comments, questions? If not, I'm going to turn it back to Roy. I'm going to come to the end here of everything I had, and thank everybody that listened. Tune in tomorrow night to the Club InfoNet on these repeaters. They're always good to listen to, find out what's new with the club, and they always have the Slop and Shop after that too. So if you want to buy and sell anything, turn it back to Roy. AC2GS, this is WS2N for the SpaceNet report for the TechNet. Back to you, Roy.
AC2GS, thank you very much, Paul. And by the way, that math puzzle dates back to the 1930s. So about 90 years ago, people came up with that one. It just shows you that some old stuff is worth dusting off and using again. Once again, I want to thank everyone who participated tonight. I certainly want to thank Andy, WA2CDL, Randy's Corner, Paul, WS2N, for the SpaceNet report, everyone who participated, who answered questions, who asked questions, who had comments, who had observations. It's all good. So thanks to every one of you. I want to remind you, if you have any questions for the technical net that you can't get on to the technical net to offer, or if you have any comments or topics or puzzlers to share, or you want me to tap Paul on the shoulder and ask him to take a look at something, the mailbag address email is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. Links to the articles that I read, links to the puzzle that I mentioned, and even a link to a page where you can calculate the decibel loss for a given coax or twin line with a given visua is available on the link page, which is roy.ac2gs.com. Then you just click on it, pick the transmission line of your choice, the length, and the standing wave ratio. It'll tell you the decibels of loss. And want to remind everyone that MikeAC2NJI has a archive of the technical net going back to September of 2006 at amateurradio.tv. So keep that all in mind, people. As I always leave you, I will ask you to remember a wise suggestion from a very wise man, Dick, K2RIW, and that is be kind to each other. It is generally a good bit of advice any old days. It's certainly a good advice these days. The COVID virus is still around. It's peeking its head around. There are hot spots in Brooklyn and Queens. Europe is starting to develop more cases daily. We might be on the next wave of this monster, and vaccines are not yet available, so please use your masks. Use your social distancing. Don't live in fear. Don't live in isolation. But be intelligent about it and take proper care for you and your loved ones. And I wish you all a healthy, happy week. And I hope that we're all back together to do this once again next Sunday night at 8 p.m. So this is AC2GS, and wishing you all a safe week and be well. And I am clear.
KD20GB Mobile.
W2VL Repeater. W2VL Repeater.
Flymark InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater.
The time is 12:04 a.m. 73 and good night from the W2VL repeater. The time is 12:04 a.m. 73 and good night from the W2VL repeater. That tonight at 8:30, this is the W2VL repeater.
Flymark InfoNet tonight at 8:30, this is the W2VL repeater. Flymark InfoNet tonight at 8:30, this is the W2VL repeater. Flymark InfoNet tonight at 8:30, this is the W2VL repeater. Flymark InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater.
This is the W2VL repeater. Good morning. The time is 5:00 a.m.
Flymark InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater. Flymark InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater.
W2VL repeater.
Flymark InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater.
W2VL repeater.
Flymark InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater.
W2VL repeater.
W2VL repeater.